Welcome to Ageless Health. This is Dr. Tom Rozelle. You're listening to Ageless Health with Dr. Tom Rozelle. And we have an amazing program for you today. And our guest is someone who I have a tremendous amount of admiration for and somebody who just kind of blows me away relative to his knowledge base, his capacity, his abilities, the things that he's done over a period of decades. But we're going to be talking about something called thermographic imaging as it relates to a diagnostic tool that is extremely cutting edge, something that really should supplant so many other forms of diagnostics because it does things that nobody else would think of doing relative to the scope of intervention with things like cancer and inflammatory disease and autoimmune conditions and so forth. But having said that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Peter Liando, one of the most amazing people who I've ever met. Again, his abilities, his experience level is extraordinary. Dr. Peter's a medical physician as well as a doctor and PhD and all types of other credentialing. I could sit back and just kind of, you know, list them, but we'd be here for a couple hours. Having said that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Peter. And Dr. Peter, welcome to the program. This is kind of crazy. I'm here in the United States, you're in Greece, and we still could make this happen, which is, based on modern technology, a beautiful thing. Dr. Peter, welcome, and tell us a little bit about yourself and how we got into the world of thermography.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to come and participate. The world of thermography has been around for quite some time, but it's only in the last maybe 10 years that it really has gained a lot more exposure and I'll say acceptance up to a certain level. But it isn't so well understood that patients can really know what best types of conditions, problems, dysfunctions that thermography can contribute to. And so our job at the moment is to continue to educate doctors and the patients themselves into the role of thermography as an adjunctive test.
Peter, tell us a little bit about what thermography actually is and how it was adapted from an industrial use many decades ago now into the medical arena and why it's so important.
Yeah, well, thermography itself is a simple test. It's a simple test of function, physiology, and so it doesn't compete with any of the imaging tests that look at structure. And most people are familiar with X-ray, CT, MRIs, ultrasound, and they all look at various different types of structure, whether it be the density of a structure or the bones or whatever, blood flow. So that's structural imaging. Thermography doesn't see any structure. Thermography just sees the physiology, the function. So things that are functional could include inflammation, pain, neurological issues that can't be imaged with an X-ray or anything that is looking at the structure. So it's an important piece of the puzzle. And when we're looking at some fairly difficult to diagnose conditions, injuries, diseases, it is important to use all the available tools and imaging technologies to get a bigger picture and to get more information that fills some of those gaps. Thermography itself has been around as far as military, industrial security is concerned for many years, but that's a different type of infrared technology because it's looking at a different range, wavelength. We're looking primarily at the very narrow range of human physiology, and that's a very specific area of infrared, and so we don't see anything that's outside that range. We don't see the emissivity of steel or wood, glass, drywall. We don't see anything that isn't within that human physiology. So it's important that we differentiate between the two.
Peter, in the world of medical application, and I want to talk about diagnostics, but I also want to talk about the ability to perceive temperature changes. But what we're looking at is we're looking at heat presentations, high or low, and that's what inflammation is. Inflammation is going to cause a heating effect in the body. And how accurate, we'll start with that, I want to take you into different processes. How accurate is thermographic imaging in determining differentiations of heat quality within the human body?
It's particularly objective, and so because of that, it is accurate. The accuracy we can break down into the actual temperature measurements when we convert the infrared radiation into temperatures, and the temperatures that we can measure are down to 1/100ths of a degree, so that's 0.01 degrees centigrade. Everything we measure in clinical applications is in centigrade, not Fahrenheit. So we have a very difference in the specificity and sensitivity. So accuracy is literally down to how accurate the temperature measurements are, but we're looking at the temperature differentials in the body. And so the accuracy is to 1/100ths of a degree, but the specificity and the sensitivity is relative to the type of condition or injury we're looking at. So if we're looking at something that is primarily a sympathetic nerve problem, then we've got close to 100% accuracy to tell whether that is a dysfunction, whether the sympathetic nerve is not functioning properly or not. We have areas of, say, lung function that have a very low specificity. So we can't be very specific about the actual type of dysfunction that we're looking at. If we're looking at a vascular issue, say a thrombosis or a varicosity, then we've got a high specificity. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. You're taking the veil off, so to speak. You know, we've been using, as you know, thermographic imaging in our office for at least a dozen years now, and our main thermographer is Dareth Painter. But we started out using it for breast thermography, and it's an alternative, you will, or a co-combined diagnostic with other procedures as well. So coming up in the United States in October is Breast Awareness Month. And so we have many of our patients that will come in and they'll have a breast thermography or they'll have a full body thermographic process done. When it comes to breast thermography and an identification of potential pathology, how does that differentiate itself between a woman going out and get a mammography? Obviously, mammography is radiation, and we know that a woman who has had multiple mammograms increases her risk actually of cancer because of the tissue damage and so forth. So how does thermographic imaging fit into that model and being a primary tool, if you will, in diagnostic when it comes to a problem with breast tissue?
Well, thermography is ideally suited to this particular application, and it's a good example of where thermography does fit in, because thermography is looking at the things that mammography can't see. It's not intended to replace mammography, because mammography is looking at the density of lesions, it's looking at tumours, it's looking at calcifications, but there's a lot that happens in the breast before anything becomes dense enough to be seen with mammography. So thermography is another piece of the puzzle. Thermography is looking at the changes that take place in vascular feed to an area, angiogenesis, which is new blood vessels going to an area, lymph drainage from that area. It's looking at the background inflammation that's caused by a tumor that produces nitric oxide. So we're seeing all these different things that we can see with thermography as an early indication of changes in the breast that can help with an earlier diagnosis with either a density that's palpated or seen with mammography, ultrasound, which can be biopsied. And also we've got the opportunity, if the patient is practicing preventative measures, to see these early changes, to see these inflammations, and actually take action before it progresses on to something that can be diagnosed. And so that's the main role of thermography, either early detection and intervention or prevention in the first place.
Peter, in your opinion, you get somebody that that gets a thermographic image, and I know, you know, your group of doctors are really excellent at saying, oh, we got a problem, you need to follow up. So when we see the follow up at that point, what are the next steps? Let's say that a woman comes in and she has something that is an increased angiogenesis in one breast or the other, and particularly we know that the upper quadrants, the upper lateral quadrants, are the ones that are most suspicious. At that point, do they do a mammogram, or should they go in and do other things first, like ultrasound and perhaps even an MRI and so forth? In your opinion, what's your recommendation?
Well, it's going to be on the recommendation of the reading doctor, and that depends on the findings. And they can be broken down into a gradable function, just the same as BI-RADs are down with mammograms. So if we have something that's a high BI-RAD, that we have three or four findings, then we'll probably recommend that structural imaging takes place, whether it be mammogram, ultrasound, or even MRI. So if we've only got one or two gradable changes taking place, then it may be necessary that the patient will, for clinical correlation, see their physician, maybe have palpation and a review of their history and symptoms, and that may lead on to ultrasound. But it depends on a number of things, the patient's age, because obviously if we have a lot of radiographic dense tissue in a younger person, then the choice may not be mammogram, because mammogram will be limited with the opinion. So there's a number of different things that thermography can actually provide decision-making information about. And so if we've got a location, then a mammogram can become a diagnostic test rather than a screening test, because we're pointing the finger at something that needs to be evaluated, to be investigated, and that may be a targeted ultrasound. It may be MRI or an ultrasound combined with mammogram, but that's up to the patient's doctor and the healthcare practitioners that are going to use the thermal findings to make these sort of decisions.
Peter, I think you're still president of DITI, and how many people do you have under your flag now? How many docs are reading these films, and how many experience-based, and that's the only thing I'm bringing it up, how many literally thousands of mammograms are you guys reading on an ongoing basis?
Well, we've come down a little bit due to the whole sort of COVID situation. We were basically handling around 2,000 patients a day, and 50 doctors or so, probably, I think we've got 13 or 14 full-time doctors, and the rest of them are part-time, but they were handling up to 2,000 a day. We're down to maybe sort of 1,200, maybe 1,500 a day at the moment. So we're some months are busier than others, but it's been fairly steady for the last 10 years or so. We started off fairly slowly the late 90s, and we've been building ever since then.
Yeah, that's a huge database, and the amount of research just from the information that you're getting is monumental. It's unfortunate that traditional medicine in this country, the United States, is ignoring things that could be very supportive and initially seeing things that they can't see, and also ruling things out. How would you compare, and I know we're getting stuck a little bit on breast diagnostics, I want to get into a couple other areas. How can thermographic imaging make a determination between something that is just a hard, uneventful situation, like a fibrocystic change within the breast, to something that is, oh my gosh, we got a problem here, we've got to get this patient into another step?
Well, we can't diagnostically, we can't give a definite diagnosis, but we can give an opinion. And the opinion is based on a number of the different findings. So if we have a localization that's hypothermic, cold, that's backed by heat, that indicates an area of tissue density, which could be a cyst, benign, or it could be something developing that isn't. We can't tell what the pathology is. If we have a vascular feed to it, that's more suspicious, and that increases the risk. If we have drain and lymph congestion, if we have inflamed lymph nodes, and we have sternal lymph and inframammary lymph inflammation, again, that's all the sort of gradable factors that the doctors who are doing the read will factor in and give an opinion. But the opinion still needs to be clarified by a biopsy. Unless you've got cells to look at, even with a mammogram with a suspicious finding, you have to biopsy before you can actually give a definitive diagnosis.
So, Peter, I'm going to shift a little bit, but because we're coming up again in October with Breast Cancer Awareness Month in the United States, there's going to be a lot of people that are watching this podcast that want to have more data, more information. And if you're in the Mid-Atlantic area, you can always go to drtomrozell.com, or you can go to Fairfax, Thermography Centers of Fairfax.com, and you can get that information. But for those of us that are not in this area, what is a website that they can go to get a referral for where they are at?
Probably the best resource is the location site on the ACCT. That's the American College of Clinical Thermology. The website is thermologyonline.org.
So thermologyonline.org. Okay, great. Thank you for that. Peter, let's shift just a little bit. And in our practice, since we've been using thermographic imaging, we also use it to determine immune function within the body. And there are several different points that I'll look at when we get a thermographic read. But how sensitive, how accurate is it to tell us, you know, your immune system's not working? And what are the potential look-ats, if you will? You know, you see something, check this out, make sure that you rule these things out.
This is probably one of the most specific and pertinent points of thermography, particularly at this stage where we're at with the pandemic. We see all sorts of symptoms that are related to the autoimmune, the immune responses. Thermography is based on autonomic response. We're seeing the results of the skin temperatures, which are being processed by the autoimmune, the autonomic responses. And so thermography is very specific, the very high specificity. And so we can use this very usefully to assess the actual status of somebody's immune system. That's done by assessing a number of different things that are well established in normal medicine and in science. And so we're looking at evidence of loss of temperature gradients. We're looking at a loss of the normal 4 degree from proximal to distal. So that's hot hands, hot feet, cold hands, cold feet. We're looking at a number of different issues related to neurogenic flare, where we've lost control of the temperature control, mainly in the head and neck and obviously the extremities. We can see a number of areas that relate to organs, mainly the thyroid. So we see inflammatory or hypothermic changes in the thyroid. We see thymus, which is a very good indicator of autonomic dysfunction, because being that is part of the autonomic system. So if the thymus is either hypothermic, which is the normal indicator we see, we also see a number of spinal issues, particularly at T1, T2. That's connected to the hypothalamus. And we see a number of other things that we have seen more observationally that we've seen over time and been given a bit of a heads up, observational information that we can use to build on that as well.
You know, you mentioned T1 and T2 areas, an area that I look at all the time, particularly when I have a patient that is in a place of crashing. And I say that in this context, we're all in fight flight and nobody really shuts down. People don't sleep the way they're supposed to. And pretty soon that HPA axis, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal pathway, which is one that sustains us and allows us to handle the tiger, if that shows up and I've got a patient that is in overdrive and they're showing all these symptoms, I know that I've got to get this person to go into what we call parasympathetic or resting stage to be able to resolve things. But it's another key indicator so often that would suggest that. And it's amazing how thermography will pick that up. It's a major cold area that shows there's very little heat that surrounds it. It's incredible. How did you pick that up? What caused you to see that piece?
Well, as I say, mainly observationally, we saw a lot of patients that were coming in with the difficult to diagnose symptoms of chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, a number of the autonomic diseases, and all of those patients exhibited this T1, T2 hypothermic pattern. We didn't see anybody who came in who was healthy, who had no symptoms or no indications of autonomic dysfunction or autonomic disease, who had this cold area. And so it was something that we wanted to look into a little bit more. There weren't any studies, there wasn't any science behind it. So it started as a completely observational issue that we'd seen over time. But it was interesting to see actually that acupuncturists had known that for 4,000 years, because it's the point that they treat needle for boosting the immune system.
Yes. You know, it's interesting. And just for our audience and they're watching this, and unfortunately we don't have graphs that we can put up for them. What we're talking about with T1, T2, we're not talking about the diagnostics that you would see on an MRI scan. We're talking about the upper portion of the back, the thoracic vertebrae, thoracic 1, thoracic 2, and that's the area that we're talking about. So when we do a full body scan to determine a patient's status, if you will, that's an area that's critical. It's an area, and when you're talking, you said earlier about the thymus gland, the thymus is in the center of the chest, right in the middle of the breastbone. And so those two pieces are critical in making diagnostics. In our offices, we will do areas of interest where we'll take a look at, for example, somebody comes in with a headache or they come in with neck pain. We want to rule in and rule out vascular involvement. So we'll take a look at the neck, particularly the arteries of the neck, the head relative to the arterial pathways. And all of those things begin to add pieces of information that allows us to approach the patient in the right situation. I'm going to move off of this just a little bit, Dr. Leando. What I want to do is talk about the application that we just put in. You were kind enough to come into our practice a few weeks back. And, you know, right now I'm jealous because you're in Greece and I'm not. But having said that, we set up a temperature screening device that is something that you've developed, and you have it all over the world in airports and different organizations and so forth. So because going through the world of COVID, every patient that came in, we were screening with a handheld device to see what their temperatures were. We haven't filled out information. But this now allows us to screen people as they walk through the door. And tell us a little bit about that application and how effective is it?
Well, it's not actually as effective as testing. So the original intention was to basically do it as an initial triage type testing to save having to have everybody temperature tested one at a time. It would take an hour to empty a large aircraft. So basically, anybody that tested positive with the fever screening coming off the aircraft was then taken to the nurse and tested and examined and asked questions, etc., etc. So it basically helped to speed the whole process up. It's not sensitive enough to get a specific sort of positive or negative diagnosis, because there's so many other things that could give you a false positive. If somebody had an abscess in the tooth, or if they're having a neurogenic flare, hot flush or something like that, they could have sinus infection, they could have all sorts of things that would cause a false positive. But it is sensitive, and you're better to have false positives than you are to have any false negatives. So it did play its part. But of course, now with all of the testing that people are needing to have negative tests before they fly, etc., it's not as important to have that taking place. It is being used a lot more in some of the big corporations for screening people coming into work. The staff, employees coming in, not only just for COVID, but also to keep any other seasonal contagious diseases out of the workplace and reduce the amount of lost time from sickness.
Well, we're extremely grateful for it, and because we're screening our staff, we're making them walk through, you know, the front doors. Our patients, where we're seeing, you know, in one office, we're seeing over 650 patients a week, and so it's ties up my staff if we have to do it manually. But now we have a screening, and as you say, what we're doing is we find somebody that's over the threshold, we're taking them aside, and we do it by manual and examination. Then it's our doctor's call, you know, what the situation is. So we're blunting as much as we possibly can. And that, in addition, then we'll do antibody screenings and we'll do a rapid testing and so forth. So we're trying to keep our office I use the word safe because we've also put in HEPA filters and the things of that nature, but to also allow our patients a sense of security, if you will, with the emotional pathways that are being exacerbated.
You've covered all the bases that you can cover. Yeah,
that's about as best we could. You know, let's just take it another piece in thermographic imaging. What can't it do? What, you know, is this something that should be used in every diagnostic mode, or is it a set aside that don't even go there under these circumstances?
There's a lot of things that there are better tests for. Wherever there's a better test, we always say use that better test. And easily to sort of think about is say prostate. It's not an area that we can image very easily, and also it doesn't tell us anything early. So you can use better tests with prostate. The lung is not going to give us a very high specificity. We can't see within the cranial vault, so we don't try and look at anything brain-wise, although a lot of the brain functions can be seen downstream in different areas of the body. But the rule of thumb is that don't expect to see anything structural. So we wouldn't use it to try and see a broken bone, because X-ray is the standard of care for that. We would see the inflammation, but that still doesn't tell us whether the bone's broken, what type of break it is. So we have to keep in mind that there are far better tests for a lot of things, and that this needs to be focused on what it can do and where its high sensitivity is and specificity is, and that is with function.
It's an amazing tool. And many years ago, when I was going back into, you know, four decades plus ago, when I was in professional school, it was just coming into the realm of acceptability, if you will, in certain pockets within the professional communities. And I remember back then, I said, well, this is really important, but never got involved to it till probably a decade after that and started studying it and so forth. But again, it's busy. So we finally brought the units in because of a series of events and people that we knew that connected to you. And I'm so impressed with the work that you've done. Obviously, there's other companies out there that are I'll use the word in competition with your organization. But the ability, the support mechanism, the diagnostics that you do, obviously the doctor has a responsibility that orders it to be able to use correlation of what they're doing relative to what the test shows, and ultimately make the appropriate referrals and diagnostics as well. So it's not just a brain dead, let's do it and this is what it's going to show. You have to put things together. But it's an amazing tool, and it's one that is developing and the applications. One other area that I want to touch on just a little bit, and we'll probably get you on and we'll talk a little bit more about this at a later point, is thermographic imaging relative to identification of allergy reactions within the body. How does that work?
Well, the body basically is reacting to something that is stimulating the sympathetic response. And as you were mentioning before, if it overrides the parasympathetics, then we get an adverse response. And so to test what we may be allergic to, we have to introduce the allergens and measure what the body's response is to them to find out what level of sensitivity the patient has. Thermography can do this without having to actually put anything invasively onto the patient or scratch, prick tests, various other things like that, because the body is very sensitive and we can see those sensitive responses and reactions without having to see a welt or a raised area of erythema or anything else like that. So it's a non-invasive way of doing pretty much the same thing as you do with a scratch test, but it's done much quicker and it's done more objectively, and particularly for pediatrics who don't take too kindly to being pricked or scratched. I think it's a better way of doing things.
Yeah, I got a couple of grandchildren that would kind of rebel against that, but in our practice, it works really well with the other pieces that we put in the puzzle. But I want to come back with that at some point and obviously have you back on, and we're going to talk about some things much more in depth. But Peter, I can't thank you enough. The information that you have, the brain patterns that you have stored are incredible. But thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Again, I wish I was in Greece with you right now. We'd share a glass together. It's an amazing opportunity to be able to talk to you at any time. It's always heartwarming, you know, to just sit and have a conversation with you. And I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
My guest today, Dr. Peter Leando, a medical physician, PhD. I mean, his credentials go on. This man has more abilities than 10 people. He's a researcher, he's a developer, he's an inventor. I'm humbled just to have a conversation with him. Again, Peter, thank you. We'll see you again soon.